I'm not going to go through all the different features of the spec and talk about each one of them in detail. Mike Keith from Oracle, who's the one of the UJB spec leads, will actually be talking about that after this talk. But I'm going to briefly present some of the basics of what there is in the JPA specification. And I hope that as we go through this code, there's a decent amount of little code snippets and whatnot in the presentation. You'll get a good feeling for how the spec works along the way. So before we dive into things, I have a couple slides here that go through what we do have in the JPA specification. So this is an entity slide. This is how you write an entity beam in the EJB3 world. And we see that we've annotated, can everyone who uses JDK 1.5 raise their hands? Everyone who doesn't use JDK 1.5 raise their hands. Okay, so about 30% of you don't. So for those of you who aren't familiar with JDK 1.5, that at entity thing is an annotation. And you'll see various different JDK 1.5 language features in this talk. I'm not going to go into detail on them. But basically what we're saying is we're annotating our class, saying that the order class is a persistent type. It's an entity we can store in the database. And then we have a private PK field that we designate as being the ID for that order class. We also specify that the value for that ID is going to be generated. So you don't need to assign it. The persistence implementation will automatically basically use a surrogate primary key strategy to populate that value. We also have an optimistic lock version field in our object, and then a many-to-one relationship and a one-to-many relationship, and then a simple date field. So a simple Java POJO class with some basic properties in it, and we've marked everything up as fields, just using direct fields, and we could have had inheritance and whatnot in here as well. So it's a kind of the model that all those of you who have been doing anything with POJO-based persistence over the last several years should be familiar with. And very easy to use, very much aligned with current best practices in the industry. We then take that and we have a stateless session beam in this example where we've marked up our class as stateless and then have what we call a persistence context, which basically means the container is going to inject into that location an entity manager reference. And then we can then use that inside of our session beam, where we then go and use the entity manager to look up objects and create new objects and store them in the database. And all the things you'd expect are happening here. Transaction demarcation is happening at the session bean level, so we don't need to do transaction demarcation code in our business logic. The kind of persistence by reachability algorithms are applied. So you basically get the behavior that you would expect, assuming that you're expecting what we expect you to expect. And Michael, like I said, will go into more details about those types of issues with the spec later on this afternoon. The important thing to see here is basically the EJB3 specification is radically new from a persistence standpoint, very different than EJB2. And we're using a kind of a familiar, comfortable kind of connection model where the entity manager can be used to access all sorts of different objects. We don't need to create a bunch of interfaces or a bunch of finder methods or a bunch of extra container-related cruft just for the sake of kind of making the specification happy. So pretty straightforward code. And that's all I'm going to show in terms of the basics of what the JPA spec is. We'll see more code throughout this that goes through different parts. And my goal for this presentation is basically to break the specification down into a few different areas that I think are particularly important and talk about those areas and the best practices in each of those different focus areas. So the way that this is going to work is that there's three different types of three different opinions I have about any one of these given features. Either it's good, which means that it has useful functionality and it's an elegant solution to a problem that we were trying to solve, or it's bad, which means that, in my opinion, it's useless or bad functionality. It's going to constrain us in future specification releases, which is always a bad thing, or it's something we're going to regret later on. And finally, ugly, which is things that I just don't like, basically. So they're not necessarily bad, I just don't think they're good, and so it's the other category. They're not elegant, the implementation isn't the way I would like to have seen it done, or something I think that we're going to want to get rid of down the road. It's not going to necessarily hurt us in the future, but it's not going to be great. One thing I'm not talking about a whole lot in this talk is stuff that's missing from the JPA spec, because there is JPA is 1.0. The JPA spec was finalized at Java 1 this year, and it is a 1.0 specification, so it's out there and available, but the flip side of that is that it's not, there's more work we can do. So a 2.0 will have more depth and breadth to it than what we have right now, and that's not a bad thing. It's good to get the spec out there and get working with it, and then we can evolve it and grow it. My focus in this talk is with what is there, what should you be looking out for, what should you be using, what shouldn't you be using. Certainly, there's plenty of room for the specification team to make new additions to the specification over time, and we can get to that a little bit in questions and answers at the end. So before I get too far into this, it's worth noting that the JPA specification is overall a very good thing. It's a Java persistence API. It's a standards-based persistence API that the community, for the most part, has agreed is worth implementing. So that means that there's a lot of people out there putting together implementations. There's a lot of people out there writing about it, working on code that interacts and improves upon it, working on, the Spring guys already have code in place that lets you use JPA in conjunction with Spring. I know of a couple of books that are out there about JPA. I know that there's people looking at doing training offerings and support, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very good thing in that it's taking something that historically hasn't had a strong, unified, well-supported standard, the persistence, the OR mapping arena, and it's putting a standard in place there that's really going to drive vendors and third-party providers to do good stuff. So getting started on actual real coding features, domain model is probably, in my opinion, the most important part of OR mapping, because OR mapping is all about you've got an object model and you have a data model, and they're different. If they're the same, if you just want to use your data model, then you don't need OR mapping. You're just dealing with your tables directly. OR mapping is all about when you have some type of disparity between what you want your object model to look like and what you have in your database. So it's a matter of converting those two and making that happen in an efficient and optimal way. So if you can't use the domain model that you want, then you're still stuck with something you don't want at the end of the day. And you might as well be stuck with the original thing you didn't want, the tables, rather than this new object model you still don't want. So domain modeling is very important to get right for OR mapping, because this is what is the interface to your database, essentially, is your domain model. It's what you'll use the most, more than any of the APIs in the specification itself. So probably one of the coolest things in the JPA specification is generics. We require JDK 1.5 in the JPA specification, and that means we can take advantage of generics across the board, and we do. So it means that we can do code like this, where we have an entity with a field of type cars, of type list that is called cars. And in the JDK 1.4 world, that would just be a list called cars, and you'd have some little documentation note there saying, this must only contain cars. And now in JDK 1.5, we can say list bracket car. And that's great from a documentation standpoint. It's great from a validation standpoint. It's extra information that the OR mapping tool can then use to optimize how it writes that data back to the database. So it's very compact. It's aligned with the language features. And it's something that really takes your domain model and makes it more expressive. So generics are way good in terms of the JPA specification. How many people here use generics already? Raise your hands. How many people don't use generics? We have a lot of 1.5 adoption in this room. That's pretty impressive. Another big benefit to the EJB spec is that your entities can be serializable. And now, they were serializable before, but they weren't really serializable. You couldn't just serialize them over the wire and get kind of the behavior you expected. One of the things we've been focusing a lot in the EJB 3 spec is kind of the principle of least surprise, meaning that we want to make sure that when we implement some feature or provide some facility to you, it does what you expect it to do. It doesn't do something different as much as possible. So in the EJB2 spec, if you returned an entity bean from a session bean method, you were getting a remote handle to that entity bean. Whereas now in the EJB3 specification, entities are always local and they can be serializable. So that means that you can actually return, in this example here, we have an entity called trade, which implements serializable, and then we have a session bean method at the bottom, which is doing some insider trading analysis or something like that, where we're looking for suspicious trades. So we execute some named query and then return a list of trades. So the EJB query execution framework in JPA allows us to construct a query from our entity manager and then execute that query, getting back a list of results. So we then cast that to a list of trades, and We're done. That goes off to the client side. That gets serialized out to the client side. So you're essentially automatically getting your detachment pattern, where in the EJB2 specification, you had to do a whole bunch of copying semantics in order to do this same code, in order to copy data out into a data transfer object and send it over the wire. Basically, now in the EJB3 specification, entities can be their own data transfer objects. That means that you don't need to deal with a lot of all the extra copying, creating new classes that parallel your exact data structures, et cetera. Something that's a little bit more questionable, in my opinion, is property access type. So we've seen in the last couple slides some field access, where in this example we had an entity bean called trade that had a field called person, a field type person that was a private field. We marked up that private field as being a many-to-one relationship. That means it's the backside of a one-to-many. With property access type, instead of marking up the field, we mark up the getter. So in this example here, we have a flight that has many carriers, and we mark up the getter saying that this is a one-to-many. So that makes sense from a modeling standpoint, but the problem is that marking up our getter method means that basically what the access type means in the JPA specification, it's an instruction from you, the developer, to the persistence provider, to whatever persistence implementation you're using inside your container, about how it should access fields in the model. So how the persistence provider should access fields, not how you should access them. Nothing to do with encapsulation. But what this means is that when you're using property access type, which you do by, like I said, annotating the getter like so, then the implementation must use your setters and your getters whenever it's accessing data. Whereas if you're using field access type, the implementation must figure out some way to dig into your object model to extract the fields directly. And property access type is, generally speaking, I have a question mark here. I kind of think it's a pretty bad thing, but there are a couple benefits to it. So the reason I think it's a pretty bad thing is that it basically trivializes your object model. It takes, it takes what you've written in your object model and turns it into something that's a trivial version of it. So in this example here, this code basically won't work for any legacy schema, or it's likely to not work for any legacy database, because in this example, the container must use the setter and getter in order to access fields. So that means when you execute a query looking for all of the flights in the database, when we come to load those flights from the database records in the database, the implementation is going to call the setter, the set carrier method, to set up that relationship. And the problem is that in this example here, when we do that, we have a little check in here, some business logic check that says, hey, let's make sure that the carrier actually flies to this airport. Because it doesn't make sense to have to build up an object model where there's some, where, for example, Hawaiian Air is trying to land at the Barcelona airport. It's not possible because Hawaiian Air doesn't fly outside of Hawaii and flights to, California. So it doesn't make sense, but maybe there was some exposition flight back, in 1973 where Hawaiian Air flew over in some flight to bring some dignitaries to Hawaii from Barcelona. So if we go and run a query saying what flights landed between August and September of 1973, we might come back with an exception during the query execution itself, because the data in the database doesn't match the rules that you've dictated in your domain model. So anytime you have data, another common example is people will have like employee data in their database where employees' salaries were less than zero. They were set to -1 if they were contractors. And so you have all these records in your database that have contractor information with -1s in it here and there. But somebody is clever and puts a rule in the object model that says salaries must be zero or greater. No one pays to work for a company. It doesn't make sense. So then you get an inconsistency between what your domain model allows and what the database wants you to do. And because we're using our setters and getters here for the implementation detail of moving data into memory, we actually will get an exception when we're loading data. And that's not what you want. You want your database constraints to be your database constraints and your object modeling constraints to be the things that your particular application must obey. And obviously, you can't violate any database constraints once commit time comes around. The database won't let it happen. But as soon as you start putting logic into the flow of loading data from the database, your business logic into that flow, then you're basically forces the developers to make sure that their database constraints and their object modeling constraints match up 100%. And this ends up being a really bad thing because it means that all of your getters and setters, all they can do is return the value. You know, set name, like our getter here just returns carrier. Our setter, all that it can actually do is that last line, carrier equals C. And that's bad because it basically takes your, it intrudes upon your object model. It intrudes upon how you do your design. That's why property field access is much, much better than property access. There's no reason why property access is more efficient or anything like that in a good implementation. Now, the reason I have a question mark here instead of just a big X is because property access, the one good thing about it is that it is easier for new implementations coming along, new JTA implementations, to do property access. They can just make a subclass of this flight class. And that's a much easier strategy to use than to go in and dig into the object model efficiently. So the good thing about property access type is that it gives a pathway for new products to come into the marketplace and to kind of establish themselves without having, with a little bit of a lower barrier to entry. But in your own work, I would definitely recommend using field access whenever you possibly can. Very good thing in the EJB world that's only good for those of you who remember EJB2. How many people, raise your hand if you use EJB2 entity beams? Okay, that's a lot less than the number of people who use JDK 1.5. So congratulations. EJB2 didn't allow inheritance. So you couldn't have you could do kind of like language level inheritance, but you couldn't create an entity beam that extended from some other entity beam in a meaningful way. You couldn't run a query that brings back all the vehicles in a database where some are cars and some are boats and some are trucks. So in JPA, we can. Kind of just that simple. It's a big problem in EJB. JPA, we've decided that you should be able to have polymorphic relationships, polymorphic queries. You should be able to use the full set of features available in the Java language. So, yay. And kind of on that note, another really good thing is that entity beams don't suck. So they used to, and now they don't. And so that's a good thing. You don't need to have an XML descriptor. If you want one, and there are some really good reasons why you might want one, then you can use XML descriptors for your entity beams. But you don't have to. You don't have to have business interfaces. You can always implement whatever you want to, because it's just a Java class. So you can do whatever you want with interfaces, but you don't have to implement this coordination of multiple interfaces and classes. You don't need to have home interfaces. We've basically taken the home interface concept and kind of squeezed it into this one entity manager class. So you kind of, the entity manager essentially becomes a generic home that can be used to find any entity beam. And also methods are altogether ignored, mostly. The only places where methods are not ignored are when you're operating on, when you're using property field, property access type, which like I said before, you shouldn't do anyway, or when you're using callbacks. So there's a callback mechanism in the EJB spec, in the JPA spec we'll get to later, and that's, of course, method-based. But there aren't any more interfaces you have to implement with certain methods. We don't have, there's no security or remoting or transactional boundaries or anything like that in the EJB JPA spec. All of that stuff is left in the session bean specification. So the methods on your entity beams are just your methods, and you can do with them as you will. You can invoke them when you want to. You can kind of, you know, do whatever you need to with your methods. That's kind of your part of the object model to play with. So we've covered a bunch of stuff about the domain model and what you have to do in your domain model, what you can and can't do, some of the basics of what's available there. Now we're going to talk some more about metadata. Basically, the metadata is essentially what we've been calling, or what I've been calling, the EJB2 deployment descriptor stuff. So it's all the data that describes what your object model looks like and describes additional information that we need to have about how your domain model works and whatnot. So this is mostly done in the form of annotations, which means that in the EJB world, in the JPA world, the EJB3 world, we don't need to have XML files all over the place. So we can have these logical annotations where we've already seen some of these already. We have an entity annotation that designates that a class is persistible into the database. It's an obvious and useful functionality. It's pretty much core to the way you write your object model. It's very rare for you to take an existing class that somebody wrote without even thinking about a database and turning it into something you're going to store in a database. So we didn't really see that as a big requirement. Rather, we were really focusing in the EJB team on the use case where you're saying, I want to write some domain model objects that I want to then store into the database. So in this example here, we know that the shopping cart is going to be stored in the database. It's an entity. It's an intrinsic property of the shopping cart class. And that's where annotations really shine, is when you're adding information that's intrinsic to the class. We also, similarly, we've designated that the PK field in the model is the ID for this object. So this is where again, our surrogate primary key value is going to end up landing. That's what that generated value annotation means. So we've designated that this is an ID and that the assignment for the ID is going to happen by the database. So it's kind of, it's almost like generated value almost belongs on the other side of an equals, of a setter, you know, in our inline right there. Obviously, we can't do that in Java, but what we're saying is that this is the ID and the value will be set for me automatically. So those are two declarative, important pieces of information about the domain model. One to many. We've designated that a shopping cart's contents, there's a one-to-many relationship between shopping cart and its items. So that's fair. Again, it makes sense from a domain modeling standpoint to put that there. So that's really good. And again, you can put that information into XML, but I think you're going to see people tending to put that into their annotations for the most part. Another neat thing in the metadata model is bootstrapping configuration. So it's a little bit small here. Sorry about that. I should have removed a couple lines. Basically, the way that bootstrapping works in the JPA specification is that there is one XML file you do have to write, because this is system-level information. Basically, you write this persistence.xml file, which lands in metainf/persistence.xml in your jar file. And basically, what it does is it identifies the persistence unit, basically all of the entity classes that you're gonna deal with at a given moment in time. And talks about, you know, some system configuration things, like what database they're connecting to. We have the JTA data store element there, where we specify the JNDI name of the data source to use for this persistence unit. We specify what mapping file we want to use for OR mapping information. We can specify a list of classes, or else we actually leave the classes out and just have them be auto-discovered. The minimal file for persistence.xml is just a single line, or actually two lines, one for the first persistence element and then one persistence-unit with a name. That's all we actually need. All the rest of the stuff can be automatically discovered or defaulted. And additionally, we can specify the provider in this XML file. So if we hadn't specified that fourth line down, provider equals Kodo persistence provider impl, then the container just chooses whatever it wants to. But we can specify that information, which means that there's a specification, kind of very easy declarative format for dictating in this container A, I want to use provider B, which means that historically the container implementations didn't have a whole lot of incentive to really innovate on their EGB2 implementations because you were stuck with your container's EGB2 implementation. You couldn't use somebody else's. And there's always this talk about making the EGB2 container something that could plug into the J2EE application server. Well, we've actually done that for the persistence provider. So in the EGB3 specification, we've actually defined a contract for how you dictate what the system configuration should look like, and in turn, how the container must behave based on that configuration. So this actually means that you can use any provider you want to inside of any container, and in a standards-based way, where you just dictate all the properties up front right there, very easy to do, and kind of makes configuration of the system something that's, again, elegantly done and something that I expect to see a lot of meaningful tooling and support around. It also gets us away from that JDBC-style bootstrapping we always had to do with connections, where you had to go and do a class.forName on the connection on the driver that you wanted to be using in order to bootstrap it into the system. We've taken care of all that behind the scenes. Now, one thing that's a little bit questionable, in my opinion, is there's some of the things that you do in OR mapping are pretty religious in nature. And by the way, it's worth noting that these different good, bad, and ugly categories that I'm putting up here, different vendors will probably have very different opinions. Different individuals will have very different opinions about whether or not I'm right on these things. So I know that Mike Keith in his talk later on today will probably have different opinions about some of the things I've said are bad, and maybe even some of the things I've said are good. So definitely, these are my opinions and should be taken as such. And on that note, there are a lot of opinions in the OR mapping world. It's a very opinionated field. And so some of these, for example, property access versus field access. I feel strongly that field access is superior. Some people like getting rid of all the logic in your getters and setters and think that's a meaningful thing to do. I also have opinions about how cascading, meaning how when you want to create a new object model and save the whole graph of objects into the database without having to traverse it manually, how that should work and things like that. And because some of these things we just couldn't come to an agreement on the expert group team, we could agree that there's a difference of opinions and multiple different solutions to be provided, but we couldn't agree on what the default should be. So what we ended up saying was, for some of these things, we're going to have system-wide toggles where you can say, well, there's this setting for example, the cascade type. And I have this big switch I can throw to say I'm going to have the default be this or the default be this. And it's up to a given implementation to decide what the default is if you don't specify anything at all. And then the implementation, the developers can then configure what they want, how they want their kind of essentially code conventions to work inside of their application. And that's really good because it was a good way to compromise. And specifications are in part about compromise. So it was good to be able to get everybody together and say, these are all meaningful and useful, but we should compromise and let people configure how they work. And that's good. That's a useful concept. However, we didn't put it into the persistence.xml file. So the obvious thing to do is to put all this data into that global persistence.xml file that's out there. And instead, most of this data lives in an ORM.xml file. So we have a persistence.xml file, which defines system-level configuration and must be present. And then we have annotations and a mix of annotations and possibly an XML file identifying, you know, the domain modeling information that we saw in annotations earlier. Like I said, that can either be done in XML or in annotations. And the ORM.xml file is the way of doing that in XML. And we ended up tucking these defaults into that ORM.xml file, where I don't really see them belonging. So that means that even if you're using annotations for everything in your model, even if you're doing a no XML approach to OR mapping, you still, if you want to toggle any of these big kind of configuration switches, you must put an ORM.xml file there just to store that information. So I'm a little bit upset with that, although down the road we can always move that data back out into the persistence.xml file if we see fit to do so. Speaking of ORM information, ORM metadata in annotations is something that I think I have mixed feelings about. So basically after you've marked up your logical domain information with all that intrinsic data about the domain model, we then have additional ORM specific information we can specify. So here we have an entity, right? And we've all agreed, or I've at least said, that entities make sense to have as that's an intrinsic property of the class, and it makes sense to have an annotation for that. But then we can also say that the table name for the entity is products. We can even specify the schema name if we wanted to. And the problem with this is that this type of data, table name data, column name data, et cetera, very often changes depending on our deployment. So depending on what database we're using, on whether we're in production or if we're in QA or in development mode, we'll be using different schemas, different table names, different, you know, there might be different maximum lengths. For example, IBM, the maximum length for an index name is 18 characters. Same thing for a join table. So you need to make sure you need to make sure your join table names are less than 18 characters long. So there are all these restrictions that the database puts on the schema that can be used in terms of naming conventions, in terms of lengths and stuff like that. And putting this data into our Java class file rather than into XML means that we basically need to recompile whenever we want to change what our schema looks like. Whenever we want to change the type of schema we're mapping to, if this information is sourced from Java, then we need to do a recompile. And that's a pretty bad solution. Anybody who's taken any code from development into production knows that once it gets past the development build phase, people don't really like recompiling on the fly just to tweak, you know, the schema name or the catalog name or something like that. Additionally, defaulting is interesting because we have default naming behaviors for example, the version field, which is used for optimistic lock versioning, is the field name is called oplock, which means the column name will turn into, by default, oplock. Similarly, the string called name, its name is going to be name. The problem is name is a reserved keyword in almost every database. So the default mappings actually won't work in the database. So you'll find that there will be places where when you're doing some basic classes and mapping them back to your database, if you don't specify OR mapping information, you're going to end up with inconsistent or impossible values from a database standpoint. And what this means is it's really valuable to externalize all that OR mapping information. Rather than putting it all here with a join column syntax, et cetera, rather than embedding all of that in your source file where it's likely to have a different life cycle, it's better to externalize that into some XML file. Because in reality, a lot of the times schemas change a lot more slowly than the Java object model. So, you know, if you're working in a greenfield project, then maybe they'll be changing at somewhat the same rate. But if you're working in an environment where you have an existing database, well, you've got your existing database, and you're going to use it, and that's it, and you're not going to change it. So you never need to change what your ORM mapping file looks like, because once you've written it once, it's done. You've got your schema, you've got your mapping, and your object model will change and evolve over time, but your mapping information can't. So it's very useful to externalize that information out into an XML file. Now, that's why there's a question mark there, marking this as an ugly feature. The reason there's a check mark is because it's kind of nice when you're just doing prototyping, when you're writing up some quick code. So from an enterprise level, it's difficult to have ORM information in your Java classes. But from a day-to-day kind of prototyping and small team development standpoint, it's kind of nice to be able to just use one file and not have to go out to all these different files to a new XML file to jump over to it to find it, and et cetera. So a single file for all of your information about a given class is kind of nice for kind of agile development teams. And what I think is going to happen over time is you'll see people start projects with table information, schema information embedded in their Java source file, just like this. And then they'll have a refactoring button in their IDE that says, extract out all of my ORM information into an XML file. And the IDE will just go through and find all the annotations that are ORM annotations and pull them out from being at table, et cetera, into a separate XML file. Yeah, that's something that's an obvious and useful refactoring. And basically, once you get to that point where your team starts realizing, oh, there's a whole bunch of noise in this file, and I don't like it, and I want to see it all in one place, and I want to change it, et cetera, then you can really easily extract it all and move on kind of into that development mode. So I think this is one of those things where it's kind of like, with my enterprise system and deployment hat on, the XML approach is much better for ORM data, but with my kind of developer ease of developing code up something real quickly hat on, it's nicer to be able to put it all in line. So I see both sides of this, and I think it's one of those features that has its use, but also has its dangers. And you should just kind of recognize when you start getting to the point where it's difficult for people to track down information or understand what's going on or see all of their table information, and know at that point it's time to move our ORM information out with XML files. So we've talked a bunch about the domain model and how you annotate that domain model, but we haven't really talked about how you write code that actually does stuff with the JPA specification. Basically, the programming model of the JPA specification is designed as much as possible to be something that's simplistic, kind of a simple, easy-to-use API set where you don't have a lot of extra methods or a lot of extra there's not a lot getting in your way. We've tried to keep it pretty lean and been able to use generics to great effect to do that. But there are a couple places where we've kind of done a disservice along the way. So probably the biggest one, before I get into some of the cool things in the programming model, probably one of the biggest ones is the fetch type defaulting behavior. And this is one of the few features I think is really kind of actively bad for the JPA specification. Fetch type, basically, here we have a class, it's an entity class, we have a bunch of stuff, and then we have a many-to-one, a one-to-one, and a many-to-one. Many-to-ones obviously are the backside of a one-to-many, which is kind of distinct. The JPA specification makes them distinct from each other, which is a neat kind of a semantic definition that there is a difference between those two. And basically, for any 2-1 relationship, so a many-to-one or a 1-to-1, the specification rules dictate how fields should be fetched. So for an ID or a name, a string type or a collection type, the defaults for primitives and intrinsic values like strings are that you should, when you execute a query or load data, you load back all of those strings and ints and booleans and stuff like that. And any collection types, you lazily load them, because generally speaking, it was deemed, it's the reasonable default is to say that you typically don't want to bring back collections immediately because they might be very large, et cetera. But for one-to-ones and many-to-ones, we'd said that all of these types are, by default, loaded eagerly. So what that means is that you might expect, if you're a reasonable developer, you write this JPQL statement. JPQL is a strict superset of EJBQL. So it's the Java Persistence Query Language, and it looks just like EJBQL with some simplifications and additions. We say select E from employee E, where E.pk equals colon pk. That's a JPQL statement that you might expect to translate into SQL that says select E.pk, comma E.name from employee E, where E.pk equals question mark. Right? Fair enough. Pretty obvious simplistic mapping there. Or a better implementation might do this, where we select the PK, the name, and then we select all the foreign keys as well. So in this table, where I'm assuming that our schema is such that the employee has a manager foreign key, an address foreign key, and a department foreign key. This is a neat optimization, because what the optimization here is that as long as you're going to the database table to pull back data from a given table, you're not doing joins or anything like that, you're just accessing a given table, you might as well pull back all of those fields, unless someone has explicitly told you not to. It's worthwhile selecting all of those extra columns that you might need down the road but you don't really know about yet. So a foreign key is small, and pulling that back over the wire isn't a big deal. So there's very little overhead to doing that additional select, and it'll be useful down the road if it turns out you do want to traverse from the employee to its manager, for example. But one of those two SQL statements is kind of what you should expect to see from an OR mapping tool, given a trivial select on an employee class. However, what actually happens is that we get this. And this actually isn't even enough. This is the best you can do in a single SQL statement, as far as I know, without using some database-specific features. But what we're doing is selecting the primary key and the name, which, like I said before, those make sense. But then we're getting the manager's primary key, the manager's name, the employee's address's primary key, the employee's address's street, city, zip, the employee's department's primary key and name, and the employee's department's company, the employee's department's company's name, the employee's department's company's address, and the employee's and related information. And then we go to the manager and get the manager's department and the manager's department's company and the manager's department's company's address, et cetera, et cetera. We have to do all that because it's eager. The spec says that when we have a relationship, a one-to-one or a many-to-one relationship, the default behavior is to eagerly load that data. And we actually don't have enough here. What we really need to do is execute this query and then check to see if the manager was non-null. And if it's non-null, we need to recurse because an employee's manager is an employee. Then we need to ask the employee's manager to get its manager and its company and its department and its address and its manager's company and department address, et cetera. So we end up with this big recursive situation where we suck in, you know, easily pull in, you know, 20 different tables worth of data just because we're doing this little query saying, give me all the employees in the database. So basically what that means is that whenever you use a one-to-one or a many-to-one in your object model, you're pretty much almost always going to want to designate that you should be using lazy fetching for that relationship. Sometimes you won't, like maybe a person you always want to get its address, or there are some one-to-ones where you want to always materialize both sides. But generally speaking, if you have any aggregation style one-to-one or many-to-one relationship, you want to make sure that you say fetch equals lazy, because you don't want to load that one up front. Becomes a big inefficiency. The good news is that you'll discover it quickly. As long as you turn on SQL logging in your product, you'll find out real fast that you're executing these huge selects where you just should be doing this tiny little thing. And if you don't notice it, your DBA will notice it and come knocking and say, you know, what's going on here. So but beware of the fetch type defaults. Now, getting back to some of the API stuff I was talking about earlier, generics are really neat. So they're still good. They were good in the domain model. They're also good in the programming model. So basically they've reduced the amount of typing you have to do. They've reduced the semantic difference between what's in your head and what's in the Java code. So here, for example, employee emp equals em.find employee.class, comma 17. That's cool. We don't need to do a cast, right? It's great. We can automatically know that we're looking for employees, and that means we're going to get back an employee. Now, it might be a subtype. It might be a part-time employee. Doesn't matter. Generics prevent us from having to write that cast. Similar, when we're doing merging, which is the flip side of our data transfer object story we were talking about earlier, basically, when we serialize data out to a different tier, we can then bring that in as a data transfer object, modify it on a different tier, bring it back into an entity manager, reattach it with this merge API. And then once we've done that, then we continue using that the value, basically the quote queue that we capture on the left side of that em.merge call might be a different object than the quote DTO reference. So we capture that and we keep on using it. We again don't need to cast. We just do it in line, it's very simple, and the language can figure out what we meant to do there. That's really good. Another good thing is outside the container API usage. So the JPA specification, we've decided to allow it to be used both inside an EGB container and also outside in a standalone J2 or Java SE environment. So again, requiring the presence of JDK 1.5, you can use a JPA implementation without a container being present. So what that means is that you have to do what the container was doing for you. You have to do your own bootstrapping, you have to do your own transaction control, and you have to do your own cleanup. So in this example here, we get an entity manager factory by using this persistence.create entity manager factory lookup method. That order's name there in quotes corresponds to the persistence unit name we saw earlier. And then we create our entity manager. Basically, it's kind of like a data source and a connection. Then we get the transaction from that entity manager and begin the transaction. We don't need to do that inside a container. In fact, we can't do that inside a container because inside a container, the transaction, the entity manager is governed by the JTA transaction in progress. Unless we're kind of doing more advanced usages, you never use the transaction APIs directly inside a container. Then we do our coding where we load some customers from a file and call persist on all of them, load them all into the database. Em.persist. That method is basically how you take a new object you've just created and turn it into something that's a registered type in the database. It's kind of like the create calls we had in EGB2. And then we commit our transaction, and we have we're good programmers, so we diligently have a try finally block that checks to see if the transaction, something went wrong during the transaction, and does a rollback if something went wrong. So that's good. The problem here is that then we then go and do we close up our resources at the bottom. The problem here and the thing to watch out for if you do use the EJB APIs, the JPA APIs outside of container, is be careful with your resource closing. Because these are meaningful resources that are often connected to the database or to a cache or to something. So we would actually need two more nested try finally blocks to make this code be, correct code. Because what we're not doing is if an exception did happen somewhere, we're leaking entity managers and entity manager factory references. So that's kind of a dangerous thing to do. Do make sure that if you are doing your own resource management, that you actually do your own resource management. You don't just do the beginning part, but you also do the ending part. Oh, and one thing to note here, that was surprising. Up arrow doesn't do what I expected it would. Up arrow goes down. So outside the container APIs, when I say outside the container, this actually means outside of a JPA container, which is not really a well-defined term in the specification. But basically what it means is that there's nothing else doing it for you. It doesn't have to be an EJB container. For example, the Spring guys have put together some code that lets Spring be a JPA container. So it kind of means you can write Spring Beans that are following the JPA rules at that level. So there might be something other than a full EJB container that's running your kind of container rules and regulations. So those container rules do apply regardless of kind of what the contained environment is implemented using. Another really good thing from an API standpoint is optimistic locking. The JPA team, we decided that the prevalent way of dealing with databases, kind of the best practice for using a database in an enterprise world is usually optimistic locking. Pessimistic locking is kind of the corner case. Sometimes you need it, and when you need it, it's very essential. But more often than not, you don't actually need it. Raise your hand in here if you use pessimistic locking more than optimistic locking. Raise your hand if you use optimistic locking. Okay, raise your hand if you use pessimistic locking more again. I see him. Okay, yeah. So it's something where when you need it, you need it, and when you don't, it's best to use optimistic, and it seems like people are doing the right thing here. So in the JPA specification, we have this version field where if you want to use optimistic locking, you toss this version field into your object model that's used by the container. This, you don't need to expose this field outside of your domain model. It's used by the container to maintain optimistic locking information. It can be an in, or it can be a long or a numeric type, or a timestamp or a date type. And basically this means that the JPA spec will do optimistic locking for you automatically. And it also means that the JPA spec will provide offline optimistic locking, which means that when you're using that detachment mode we were talking about earlier, where you take objects and send them out over the wire and bring them back in, the JPA implementation will automatically check to make sure that the data didn't change while that record was out somewhere else in the world. The data in the database didn't change, so it'll provide optimistic locking guarantees even in a detached environment where you don't have a full proper transaction. So that's very cool. One thing, that the spec doesn't specify pessimistic locking yet. So the guy over here who uses pessimistic locking, every implementation out there I know of has support for pessimistic locking one way or another. It's just that right now it's not part of the standard. So it's one of those places where, like I said before, the specification doesn't cover 100% of the footprint of what you might need. It covers a lot of it, maybe 90, 95%. But there are places like pessimistic locking where you'll need to use your vendor-specific, you know, locking behavior to, you know, either use some API or some configuration or what have you to use that pessimistic locking. So even though it's not in the spec, it's usually going to be there in an implementation. And you should definitely feel free to do that. From a specification standpoint, there's nothing wrong with using extensions that your vendor provides if that's a useful, meaningful feature. You shouldn't use only what's in the spec and kind of close your eyes to everything that a vendor provides, because sometimes there's good stuff in there, and often if people use it, that often turns into a feature in the specification down the road. So queries, we've seen a couple brief touches on queries already. Queries are basically, like I said before, a full superset of what's available in EJBQL. That means all of your old EJBQL queries should work in the JPA spec just fine, assuming there are no bugs in your implementation, of course, but that's always the case. We've made a bunch of additions as well. So one of the biggest, most notable ones, in my opinion, is the ability to do dynamic queries. And this is really a biggie, because in EJB2, queries were always static. You had to define a named query and then write up and then reference that named query. Dynamic queries are key for an advanced application. When you want to do something where your query needs to have like an assembly builder page, where somebody can go into the advanced section and, you know, add in multiple different and or clauses via some web interface, you need to have the ability to then turn that dynamically assembled and dynamically specified query that the user said they want to use into something that is actually meaningful, you know, that you can then execute on the back end. And obviously creating a named query for every possible combinatorial option in your domain model isn't a feasible thing to do. So dynamic queries are really pretty important in terms of writing advanced and high-end persistence applications. What you do is you just say entitymanager.createQuery, and you pass in the string that you want to use. You can create that string however you want to. Obviously, this example is just a static string. It could have been a named query, but you can imagine building up that string in some for loop that analyzes whatever you need to be, you know, querying over. Then we can then set parameters. So instead of the positional syntax, the question mark one, question mark two, et cetera, syntax from the EJB 2 days, EJBQL in EJB3 supports named parameters, where you can actually say colon fname is then addressable as a positional, as a named parameter. When we say set parameter fname comma Joe, we can do that on a named basis, which is neat. And then, like we saw before, we then execute that query and get back a list of results. Pretty straightforward stuff to do. It's only worth mentioning because the EJB2 spec didn't do it. There are a couple things like that in the EJB3 spec. Another really cool thing is ranged queries. And this is something you've been seeing in different OR mapping specs and products over the course of the last couple years. All of the databases out there that I know of, all the databases that our product supports except for JDataStore, support some way of doing database side limits to the amount of data you want to bring back from the database. So in Oracle, you have to do some nasty sub-selects. In SQL Server, you specify, I think it's a limit range or limit offset or something like that. And all sorts of different SQL extension syntaxes for all the different databases. And not a single one of them is done the same way. Not even SQL Server or Sybase, which actually came from the same code base, use the same facilities for doing this. So nobody does it the same way, but it's always doable. And this is the beautiful, this is exactly the type of thing that a JPA provider should be taking care of for you. One of the benefits of OR mapping is letting a product, a third-party product, take care of understanding the differences between a whole bunch of different types of databases. So what we can do in JPQL is just say set first result 20, set max results 10. And this says, execute this query, but start at the 20th result and only bring me back 10. So it's very useful when you're writing a web page that's letting you page through all the results, where you want to say, you know, results 1 through 20, or, you know, in this case, 20 through 30 of 538. You can very easily do that by executing a bunch of different select statements that kind of walk through those pages sequentially. Obviously, sometimes, you know, obviously there's isolation issues with doing that, because every time you execute the select statement, you're probably coming back in a different database, you know, connection context. So if you do want to be able to process a full result set and maybe walk through it with a scroll of a cursor or something like that, sure, you can do that, and the spec allows you to do that. But in cases where you want to be able to just get chunks and specify exactly which chunk you want to get, you can do that using these ranged APIs, which are really useful. I'm kind of amazed that hasn't made it into the SQL standard at this point. It seems like, or the SQL collective, you know, pseudo standard at this point. It's such an obvious and important thing to do. Aggregates and projections are another really good thing. So, in the EJBQL world of EJB2, we didn't have a whole lot of powerful reporting capabilities, and we've added a bunch more capabilities into the EJB3 specification. So here's an example where we're looking for some kind of basic reporting about our running system. We're looking for the min, max, average, and sum of the price for all the items in the database. So we want to find out, you know, what's the cheapest item in the database, what's the most expensive, or what's the price of the cheapest item, what's the price of the most expensive, et cetera. And we want to do this just for some basic reporting statistics generation information. Very easy to do. You just do that using these aggregates and projections built right into the spec. And we can use group by, we can use all sorts of different concepts like that. I'm not going into detail on that here, but you'll probably hear more about that from Mike later on. So that's really useful and cool. It means that you basically don't need to use SQL in your applications. Most of the time in your applications, you can live in the kind of domain modeling world where you're using JPQL instead of diving down into your database-specific SQL, which means that the benefit of doing that, of course, is that you end up, the more you put direct SQL inside of your OR mapping code, the more places you need to update whenever you make a change to how a given mapping is set up, the more places you need to kind of monitor when you're looking at how your cache works and things like that. So this facility basically means that you can do proper interrogation of your domain model. It's not full-on data warehousing type, you know, data analysis, but the basic OLTP stuff we often need when we're doing enterprise applications. You can also pack results into custom classes, kind of like in the JBC 4 specification, where we can say select new item price data, where item price data is some class we've defined that has a constructor that matches with this, or setters and getters that match up with what our signature type looks like here. And this is kind of neat because it means that we can execute queries and get back data in the result we then want to turn it into to hand off to some other part of the framework. So it's nice because it means that instead of getting back an object array, like in the first example, and then converting that object array into something we pass off into the presentation tier of the application or whatever, we can actually ask the persistence provider to do the work of creating the result class that we want to actually be rendering the results out into for the end user. It's a very neat way of being able to do selects and get data out in the form, in the shape and the form you want to. Now, you shouldn't use this to, you shouldn't say select new employee and then like e.name, e.id, e.whatever. You shouldn't use this instead of doing it. This isn't a way to create managed objects. So whenever you do a select like this, you're getting back an object that's not something the JPA container knows nothing about it. The persistence provider won't track any changes you make to those statistics. It won't update them when you commit the transaction. So it's really just taking, it's just a way to make, it's helping you make a copy of data in the format you want it to be. And you shouldn't use it for coercing data into your actual domain object classes, because generally speaking, that won't do kind of what you expect it to. We do support name queries, of course, still, because name queries are an important thing to have in the specification. But there's a big problem with how we support them, which is that the signature takes a string as the argument. So create name query takes a single string argument for the whenever we create a new name query. And this is a big difficulty because it means that we have global scoping of our queries. So all of our queries are defined as being globally scoped as whatever that string that we pass in. That's the token we use to address and load that query. Global to the context of our persistence unit, of course, not global to the JVM. But that's bad because it means that developers can't reuse query names. You can't have the same query name, you know, find all on the person class and define somewhere else in a different class. It also means that at load time, the system has to do a lot more work to load and scan different locations on disk. And finally, it means that future versions of the spec, we can't have local queries be the default. So we're kind of stuck with this. Unless we add a new annotation or XML element in the future, and we'll talk more about that in a second, we're kind of stuck with this down the road. So what does this look like in code? Well, we have some code that says that we have an entity called person, and then we've annotated a named query into place, where we say that the named query's name is find all, and the query is select P from person P. So we could have, again, done this in XML or in annotations. In this example, we're seeing the annotation version of how to do that. And that's all well and good. And then down here we say query Q equals em.create named query find all. Then some you know, fool on the development team comes along and writes some other find all method on the purchase order class. So somebody comes along and creates a new name query also called find all. Maybe you're migrating all of your EGB2s to EGB3s or something like that. And of course, now there's no way to figure out what to do when you ask for the name query called find all. So we basically put ourselves in a position very easily where the system, something that you might expect to have happen to you on a regular basis, the system just can't tolerate at all. So the reason this is bad, like I said earlier, is because we can't undo it. We can work around it, and there are a couple things we can do. So for example, down the road, we could, instead of having the at named query annotation we saw earlier, we could have an at named local query annotation or something like that that we encourage people to use instead of named query. But it's a little bit uncomfortable to do that because it brings up this dichotomy between the named query and, you know, what's a named query, what's a named local query, when do I use them, et cetera. Generally speaking, global strings are bad. This is the place where they're worst. They're also used in SQL result set mappings, which is kind of an advanced feature for when you need to use SQL as a query language instead of EJBQL, and your SQL is particularly unexpected. So the implementation can't just make some assumptions about what it should do. And we also use name queries, global scoping and entity names. That's actually not such a bad thing. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. And that's actually how I suggest people work around this problem, is because entity names are a global string anyway, the suggestion that I'm making to people to use is to always prefix their query names with the entity name of the class that you've located the query on. So when you specify the query that's looking for person objects or that's annotated on the person class or something like that, you say person.findAll. And then that means that by convention, you can then enforce within your team that all of your queries say, you know, entity name dot find all or entity name dot query name. And then you won't have any of these issues, because then we have entity name, a person to find all and purchase order to find all, two separate queries when we do the lookups, because they're two separate global names. So I'm hoping that tooling will suggest this type of a thing. I know that the tooling that we're making at BEA will suggest this as best practice. So you'll get a little squiggle, you know, warning squiggle underneath things if you don't scope your queries properly. I hope to see that elsewhere in the industry as well. So that pretty much covers the different categories, the different major categories I see in the specification. Now we're going to dive into a couple miscellaneous things that I don't really know where they fit. The first one is probably the one thing in this presentation that I'm most ambivalent about, that I'm not really sure exactly what, I kind of go back and forth on whether I should have a check or a question mark or what here. So, we, like I said before, there is a facility in the JPA spec for having callbacks and designating basically different methods that get invoked at different life cycle points in the applications, in a transactions, or in an object life cycle. So the example here on the left, we have what you can do in the spec, which is that we have an account entity, and we've designated that before persisting that record to the database, we should call this validate method. Kind of a cool thing to be able to do. But the way we do it is by saying at pre-persist. In the EJB2 specification, you had to implement this one interface, always, that had a whole bunch of different callbacks. And most of them were usually empty because no one really knew what to do with them, and so they were almost always just, you know, not necessary. In the EJB spec, in the JPA spec, we've identified we don't want that approach, but I think we went a little bit the wrong way in terms of the solution. So what the spec says is what's on the left. We have an annotated method that we say at pre-persist on. On the right is how I think it should work, which is that we should say implements persist callback, and then we have some method in persist callback called JPA pre-persist. And the reason I think that we should be doing it with an interface, the right granularity interface, is because the example on the left means that the persistence implementation, the persistence provider, has to go and reinvent the whole language rules, all the language rules out there for method overriding and basically how all the rules about how interfaces work in the first place. Because what if account extended for something or something else extended account? You had, you know, different types of accounts for preferred accounts and regular accounts. And you wanted to also do some pre-persist logic there. Well, what happens if you annotate pre-persist on another method? Or what if we had two methods in this class that both had pre-persist annotate on them? What if there were what if we had method arguments to validate? What if validate took in, you know, a thread, the current thread for the context that we're executing in? You know, all sorts of possibilities for things that could go very wrong that aren't because we're using an annotation and we're using kind of something very a reflection approach very much outside of how Java works. We have to reinvent all these rules and reinvent code that enforces them, and our IDE and our compiler won't validate those things for us. So I think that's a little bit difficult. However, annotations for lifecycle callbacks in an externalized, we also have this capability of creating what we call an entity listener, which is basically taking our lifecycle callbacks and externalizing them from our class, putting them into a separate class. And this is kind of bad in the same way, but it's also kind of neat. So the top is our entity class, and then the bottom left is what we, the bottom left in this example is what I think we should do. The right is what's actually in the specification. So in the specification, we say at pre-persist void validate account A. The alternate way of doing this is to say implements pre-persist listener. It's not in the spec, but that's an alternate thing we could be doing, and then have a pre-persist call. Again, the approach we've chosen in the specification of using an annotation is a bit difficult because it means that we have all those same problems. It's a validate class extended to some other class. What do we do, et cetera, et cetera. But the cool thing that happens here is that we do get the ability to say that the argument passed into the validate call is an account rather than just any old object. So in the example on the left, the pre-persist, we were passing in an object. We had to cast it to an account. Whereas in this example over here, we can just take in any object of any type, and we specify what persistent object we want it to be. And assuming that matches up with our current runtime environment, this particular validate method will be invoked with an account. So it's kind of a neat way to get a little bit more type safety when we're externalizing our validations from the class itself. But I'm still a little bit, like I said before, it's one of these spec features I'm a little bit nervous about because I think it's annotation abuse, but it's also kind of cool. So the part of me that likes cool, shiny features likes it. And the part of me that thinks that we shouldn't abuse annotations doesn't like it. And I said before we'd talk about short entity names. So sure enough, here we are. In JPAQL, you'll see something like select C from customer C. And what we're doing here is we just specify customer. We don't just specify, you know, org.myframework.mypackage.dao.jpa.customer. So it's much shorter, which is a nice thing. It's often more intuitive than something like this. This is the bottom example here. It's not in the spec. It's kind of a chaotic example where we just say select C, and we know it's from the customer class because we specified that as a type safe a class object. It does require a full scan to compute the entity names, so that's kind of bad. Just like with the queries earlier, we do have to do a little bit too much work. And it wouldn't be an issue if Java had something like a link equivalent. So link is the C# mechanism where you can actually embed different languages inside of your C# source file. So if we could actually embed a different language where we had strongly typed JPQL directly there instead of inside of strings, but inside of the language, we could get away from that. And finally, the last thing that to mention is ease of use is both good, bad, and ugly, because the spec is a lot easier to use, and that's good. And that was a major goal of the whole Java EE 5 project. But the problem is that it became the thing that everyone brought up as kind of the atom bomb on the expert group, where if I felt strongly about something, I'd be like, oh, this is important for ease of use. And someone else would feel the opposite about that same feature and say, no, it's important we do it the other way for ease of use. So lots of arguments ended up talking about ease of use instead of actually what was going on. And it became kind of the thing you say when you're not sure why something should be the way it is. So I'll leave this resources page up so that you can read about it, if I can get back to it. We have about 5 or 6 minutes for questions and answers. So the microphone is walking around with Kelly. And there's a question right over here, I see.
I noticed you didn't have a big red cross on something saying that this is not JDO. Can you talk about the future of JDO versus the future of HIV3 persistence?
I didn't have a big red cross saying this is not JDO. I'll talk about it briefly, but I'm not going to go into a ton of detail on it. I can talk about it more offline. But basically, the EGB spec is not JDO, and that might seem surprising to people who know JDO. But it turns out there's a lot of politics involved in how expert groups run, and I'd say that it's not uncommon for politics to outweigh cool-headed decision making, and it's possible that the JDO and EJB. I actually wasn't involved in the JDO EJB debates within Sun, but I think it's likely that there might have been politics involved there at a certain level. The future for JDO, we have the JDO 2 spec is out there and finalized and is pretty good. I think what you'll see, Sun has said that they're working to merge the JDO and EJB specifications together. I don't know what that means because I've heard different things from different people within Sun about that. But the person to ask is probably Linda DeMichel. She's the Sun person who's in charge of the EJB spec. So her and Craig Russell are ostensibly working on merging the two specification stacks together in some meaningful way. Question in the back?
I might have missed it, but how soon is Sun next to OpenJPA?
Good question. So OpenJPA is... We're basically taking parts of Kodo, which is BEA's JPA implementation, and turning it into an Apache project. It's kind of in flight. So we've done we've done some code submissions to Apache and are working on more as we speak. Well, let's see. It's 3, 6 a.m. It's 6:42 on the West Coast, and the people who are working on this on the West Coast, so we're not working on it as we speak, but later today people will be working on it, and they're kind of it's an ongoing project within BEA. I expect to see more code getting out there in the week's time frame, and I'm not sure when we're going to have a full JPA compliant solution. We have to figure out licensing terms and all that stuff for how to get the TCK to validate it. The BEA, the code base is coming from Kodo is JPA compliant past the TCK, but for Apache project to be JPA compliant means something different, and I don't know the details of that. But I expect to see more code landing there in the coming weeks at the latest. Sign up to OpenJPA commits or OpenJPA dev at incubator.apache.org for more details. Another question up here? The question is, how about possibilities of compile-time validations of query expressions? It's an interesting topic that there's a lot of research going on with right now. I touched on it briefly, mentioning Link. So EJBQL or JPQL queries are not validated at compile time. Dynamic queries obviously can't be, because they're dynamic, and so the best you could do is that when you assemble them. But static queries could be validated earlier. And that's actually one of the benefits of named queries, is that once you've externalized your queries into a named query, even if you aren't validating it at the Java C level, you can pretty easily validate it at the APT level. And in Java 6, APT and Java C are the same thing. So you can do validations at that level. In terms of writing queries using something other than like an opaque string, I know that there's work going on in terms of there's some people in Texas and in the DB4O project here in Europe who are collaborating on work for writing Java code that then turns into a named query by basically analyzing the bytecodes to figure out what the Java code's doing, and assuming that you write a subset of Java that is something that you can query on, that turns into a query. I also know that there's a lot of interest within the expert group of creating a mechanism for allowing people to write basically an internal DSL format, for an internal domain-specific language format for writing a query. So instead of putting it into strings, writing a bunch of method declarations that let you and or together different predicates, which is compile time structure validation, but not necessarily compile time semantic validation. So I know of those two efforts that are going on. I don't know of any efforts to do something like Link in the Java world. So I'd really like to see something like that. But my understanding is it's unlikely because of the Java language specification and the Java compiler, the actual parser that parses the Java source files, are kind of intertwined. So to change the compiler and change the parser such that it could deal with different tokens, like some tokenized format that lets you switch languages in the middle of the compilation tree, is something I don't think that the Java compiler really, I don't think is very feasible. So until we see like solid Java C that is using a more structured extensible AST for defining what the language looks like, kind of a better grammar, I don't think we're going to see Link in Java anytime soon. Anything else? I think I'm out of time, so thank you guys very much for showing up, and I hope that you learned something. I'll be around if you have more questions. Come up to me either after this talk or around the conference. Thanks.